You're listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and we have a show that we recorded earlier this week to play for you today, an interview with Ari Berman, who is on a national speaking tour for his book, Herding Donkeys, The Fight to Rebuild the Democratic Party and Reshape American Politics. And Ari will be speaking at Prairie Lights Bookstore on Thursday, October 21st, 7 p.m. That's next Thursday for those of you listening on Friday. And it is this Thursday for those of you listening Monday morning. So I'm sure that Ari would welcome lots of support from Fairfield at Prairie Lights in Iowa City at 15 South Dubuque Street. It's a great opportunity to hear the inside story of the Howard Dean and the Obama campaigns. And so we look forward to seeing Ari in Iowa City on Thursday, October 21st. And now here's Writer's Voices. You're listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, open source, community, grassroots, solar-powered radio here from the heartland. And this is Writer's Voices. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me today is my recurring and always welcome guest host, Cheryl Fusco-Johnson.
Well, it's great to be here, Monica, especially in light of who you're interviewing today.
Of course, yes. When Cheryl found out that I was interviewing our guest today, she said, oh, I know him quite well, and in fact had written a review of his book already.
And that's so, right. Yeah, Ari and I have already chatted about this book, and I have further questions that I'm really excited about having the opportunity to ask him today.
So our guest today is Ari Berman, a political correspondent for The Nation and an investigative journalism fellow at The Nation Institute. His writing has appeared in the New York Times. He's a frequent commentator on MSNBC and National Public Radio. He lives in New York City, but he used to live right here in Fairfield. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Ari.
Hey, guys. Thanks so much for having me, and thanks for the excitement.
So, Ari, this is your first published book, I understand. Is that true?
It is my first, yes.
Herding Donkeys.
Maybe my first and last.
Oh, well, we'll see about that. Herding Donkeys, The Fight to Rebuild the Democratic Party and Reshape American Politics. And it just came out this month, I believe.
Yeah, it just came out earlier this month.
Which is October 2010. So how does it feel to be a published author?
It's stressful. You have to keep reminding yourself that this is supposed to be fun. But I mean, it is actually, in all seriousness, it is kind of amazing because, you know, I had spent 2 years really working on the book, and everyone, a lot of people knew I was working on it, but they didn't really know what it was going to be like or what I was going to produce. So it does feel really nice to be able to share it with people. And just the idea that anyone is reading your book, I think, is kind of exciting. And not only that, but people seem to be responding really well to it. I mean, obviously, you know, the political climate is pretty crazy now. And so people's responses kind of vary based on that. But I think, you know, just in terms of the actual writing of it and the reporting I did and the story, I mean, I think people seem to be responding well to it. I mean, and that was really what I wanted to get out of it. For me, it was, you know, it was as much about the process and the outcome as the message, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. And while we're talking about the process, Ari, I was interested in the fact that part of the reason this book was published was because you were first blogging. And today many writers are getting the advice to blog first to get experience. And I'd like you to comment a little about how your writing blog.
Sure. Well, first, Cheryl, I want to thank you for the great interview that you did for The Source. And I really enjoyed reading it. It was really fun to talk, and obviously you were one of my first writing teachers, so in some ways all the credit to you. But in terms of, you know, blogging, it's interesting because I really started blogging for The Nation because that was the way that they were going to hire me. I had written some pieces while I was an intern that were more long form, but I mean, everyone was interested in just blogging at that point, so they hired me to do this daily blog called The Daily Outrage. But what I really wanted to do was long-form journalism, and so I actually used blogging to segue back into long-form, which I think is sort of the opposite of what people are doing today, which is a lot of journalists are ditching print for the web, and they're starting to blog, and a lot of younger people are starting to blog, and that's really sort of all they're doing. And so for me, blogging was just an in terms of journalism because, you know, when I went to journalism school and I had an idea of wanting to be a journalist, it wasn't to be a blogger. You know, I wanted to do serious long-form journalism, and then as I did, you know, more long-form journalism, that segued nicely into a book. And now, you know, I mean, and obviously I wouldn't want to write another book tomorrow. It's a tremendous amount of work. It's very hard to do, and it's very hard to do well. But at the same time, you know, it's so much more, there's so much more freedom and so much more expression in books. And so now, after writing a book, blogging seems like a waste of time. It's sort of pointless, even though, you know, we all have to do it to stay up on the times.
It's really interesting to hear you say that because I have heard a lot of my writing friends, some of whom are, you know, have been published a lot, have written a lot of books, think that perhaps blogging is a trap. So I guess people will have to decide on their own path. For you, it was an unusual path because you started first with, you know, as you're saying, writing long articles.
I mean, the interesting thing is, you know, Jonathan Franzen, who obviously has his new book out, recently said he was doing an author video, and he has the same publishing house as I do. So I saw the video, and he said, you know, I don't really like doing these videos, even though he was doing one. And he said, because, you know, books are supposed to take you to a still place. Mm-hmm. And I kind of actually liked that, even though it was sort of snobbish the way he said it. But, I mean, I didn't kind of like that because it's true, like, blogs are noisy and you don't really process them and you're reading them online and it's just sort of, you're always clicking on other stuff and you're whizzing through it very quickly. And by definition, it's very hard to do that in a book. I mean, it's very hard to just breeze through a book, and if you do that, you don't really get the essence of it. So, I mean, I think, you know, I think there's still definitely a place for books, and I think, if anything, there's more of a place for books in this sort of ADD, always-online culture that we're living in.
Oh, that's really interesting.
That's interesting. You think there's more of a place for books now?
I think they're more important than ever before.
They're more important.
Because, you know, back in the day, if you were, like, writing on your felt pen and you had nothing else to do, and you picked up a book, I mean, that's great, but, like, what were you going to do otherwise? If you were, like, in the 1700s or the 1800s. But, I mean, I think, you know, now, you know, books are a refuge, right? I mean, we read them on vacation, or we read them before we go to sleep, or we read them on a lazy afternoon to really transport us. And obviously, you know, a book like this is sort of more serious in nature. I wouldn't necessarily advocate this as like a bedtime story. But at the same time, I do think that it is nice to just, you know, it's very hard to read a book and check your iPhone. Now, you can read a book on your iPhone, but if you do that, that's going to be the only thing you're doing. And so, by nature, it's difficult to read a book and multitask. And so, I think that's what I mean by that, in that, you know, the experience of reading a book can't really be totally replicated in our culture in terms of multitasking and everything like that. Now, people seem to predict that people will eventually stop reading books. I don't really see that happening. I think maybe more people will read them on their iPads or on different formats, but I think studies show people are still reading. It's just that the industry, for reasons that I don't think have much to do with consumers, is starting to really contract.
One of the things I found very interesting when you and I discussed this book earlier was that having a narrative arc was so important to you. And you're writing nonfiction. Maybe you could explain a little bit to people what this book is, and then we'll talk about fiction techniques and nonfiction.
Yeah, well, I mean, I wanted to tell a story about politics, but I wanted to tell it in as accessible a way as possible. And so for me, it wasn't a matter of, I basically kind of knew the story, which was about the evolution of the Democratic Party from Howard Dean to Barack Obama, and really about an attempt to explain and to illustrate the grassroots political movement that came up through the Obama campaign, and give the roots of it, which I viewed as Howard Dean, and then to give, you know, the present day, which is sort of the fights that are ongoing in the White House and the rise of the Tea Party and all that. But at the same time, you know, I kind of, except for the Tea Party bit, which I didn't really expect when I started writing the book, because no one could foresee this, but except for that, I really knew the story, and it was just a question of, okay, how can I tell it in an engaging way where someone who's not a political junkie can pick it up? And will could it be able to read it? And I thought of a lot of my friends in that sense who aren't political junkies, but I wanted them to be able to read it. And so I tried to look at, you know, dialogue and characters and pacing and narrative, all the things that really make a good book. I tried to do that with political books because I knew that no one was going to want to read, you know, a dry 250-word book that's just, you know, one paragraph with no quotes or dialogue or color. And so I really tried to dig down in these different characters that are in the book and kind of get at, you know, who they are, what's motivating them, what work they did. And that was some of the stuff that, just for space reasons and for stylistic reasons, I wasn't able to do very much at The Nation.
Now, Ari, there's a lot of stories that you could have told. Why this one?
Well, after the election, I was looking at all the different books that were going to be published about the Obama campaign, and I had a fair idea of what they were going to be like. And they seemed to me that they were going to really follow two different models. One was going to, they were going to be very much about, you know, Obama and the man, right, and his interesting biography, and et cetera, et cetera. And the other one was going to really be about the campaign told through the guise of the inner circle, right, Obama and his team. And I saw that, you know, for example, with the first book after the election that came out, Renegade, by Richard Wolff. I mean, these were reporters who I think, you know, were telling a story, but they were sort of telling, you know, their sort of conventional version of the story. And I thought that the real story of the election, and even moving forward, was going to be about, you know, all these people that got involved in the Obama campaign, you know, at the bottom level, at the bottom up grassroots level, and then were really able to shape the campaign in their own image. And so the Obama campaign was really a vessel for these organizers and activists. And I thought the other interesting thing was how all these different states were able to go from quote-unquote red to blue. So places like, you know, Indiana and North Carolina and Colorado. And I thought that was really fascinating because they weren't just going from one candidate to another. I mean, they were going from one ideology to another, and a lot of these places were thought of as very conservative. And so I thought, you know, there's a lot about the country we didn't understand. And by talking to people in these states who organized for the Democrats, I could understand, you know, how a place can change and how a country can change. And that would be a really interesting window into a broader American story. And I really thought that, you know, not only was that story about Obama, but I really wanted to broaden it. And so I really viewed the roots of the Obama movement in, you know, Howard Dean's campaign for the presidency in 2003 and then his chairmanship of the Democratic Party from 2005 to 2008. And I thought, you know, all the Obama books were really missing that, that Dean was the John the Baptist figure to Obama. And so I wanted to tell the story from Dean to Obama, and then two, I wanted to tell the story with Obama through the eyes of all these different organizers and activists who I thought had really compelling stories that otherwise would not have been told. So that's really what motivated me to write the book.
Could you talk a little bit about how being from a small town helped equip you to write this book?
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously I'm from a sort of atypical small town, but nonetheless it is a small town, and nonetheless we did grow up in Iowa, and I was always aware of the sort of broader social norms of the state. And the interesting thing to me was that I felt like when I moved to the coasts, you know, to New York and Washington, and even somewhat in Chicago, I felt like people had these very unrealistic portrayals of what life was like in sort of middle America, like it was all just a bunch of dumb hicks. And I thought that, you know, the red states had stereotypes about the blue states, and the blue states had stereotypes about the me to relate to the stories of people in Indiana or North Carolina, for example, because they weren't necessarily so different from my own, and it made me want to search out people in these that were off the beaten path. And I thought that, you know, these were parts of the country that, you know, were too often ignored, and the stories really weren't told from. And I think, you know, part of the reason that I want to tell those stories, I think, is because from growing up in a place like Iowa.
I think it would be interesting to listeners also to know that your agent, and the fact that you got an agent because of your blogging, but your agent proposed two other books to you first, and you refused to write the two books that your agent proposed, even though he was a very experienced, accomplished.
Yeah. Well, the first, I actually met my agent when I was doing this Daily Outrage blog, and I was doing the blog because it was during the Bush administration, and it was very easy to be outraged every day. And so it was kind of a grueling slog to have to write every day about another outrage. I mean, it kind of sort of took its toll on me. And so when Nick said, you know, you should write a book about these things, I was like, you know, there's no way I'm doing that. That's not going to be very good, and it's not going to be very, very fun either. I view the writing itself as too limited in terms of the blogging, and I was also just too young. I mean, I was like, you know, 23 at that point. I just wasn't really ready. And then, you know, when I moved to Washington, which I moved to Washington, and I was there from 2005 to 2007 as a Washington correspondent for The Nation, and I really covered Congress and Capitol Hill and really got a good sense of Washington. And my agent wanted me to write a book about the culture of Washington, which I actually thought was really fascinating topic, but at the same time, because it's such a perverse, weird culture there, it's so unlike the rest of the country. But at the same time, you know, that would have required me to immerse myself in the culture of Washington, and to go hang out with all these depraved, weird people, and I didn't want to do that. So I didn't want to just be hanging out with a bunch of weird lobbyists and legislators in Georgetown. And so I was like, you know, good idea, but it just doesn't really feel natural. And the thing about, I think, in terms of if I have any perspective on this, I mean, it's just that, you know, you have to write a book about a subject matter you feel passionate about, because it's a very lonely, isolating process, and no one can really help you through it. And even though, you know, I had a very good publishing house and I had a very good editor, I mean, that only got me so far. I mean, they helped me lay it out, and they read some early drafts and stuff, but I essentially, you know, wrote, you know, 80,000 words with no editorial supervision, which was kind of daunting. For me, I hadn't really written an article that was longer than 5,000 words before, and so at least in print. And so it was sort of a test for myself, like, you know, would I be able to do it? And that's one thing I actually enjoyed about the process. But I had to work very hard and stay very disciplined throughout it.
One thing that many writers do is use some books as a template, and I thought perhaps you could share the books that you used as a template.
Sure, yeah. I mean, I had a few different books that I sort of glanced at various times that sort of helped focus me. One book was Rick Perlstein's book about Barry Goldwater, which is Before the Storm, and Perlstein tells the story of the conservative movement that really rallied around the Goldwater campaign and basically posits Goldwater as the figure that led to Reagan and the Republican Revolution. And I sort of want to do the inverse with Dean and tell a story of the progressive movement that came up, the grassroots progressive movement that came up, you know, through Dean and then Obama. And I viewed Obama as sort of the Reagan to Dean's Goldwater. Initially, I think it's more complicated now, but that's how I viewed it initially. And so that book was definitely a template for me. I mean, another template was this great book about political reporters called Boys on the Bus, which I think, you know, is sort of a must read to anyone who wants to read political journalism. And I think, you know, the interesting thing about that book is just that the characters are so rich, and the different reporters that populate the story are so interesting, and you really feel like you're there. And again, it's a book that's very hard to emulate. It's so well written. But at the same time, you know, I did look at it as a template. And the other book I looked at a little bit, which is more, what I guess, equally contemporary as Before the Storm, was this book by Jonathan Mahler, The Bronx is Burning, which tells the story of New York in 1977, but it does it through the New York Yankees and the Son of Sam killer and all these different stories. A ton of stuff happened in 1977 in New York. There was a big fire, and there was a blackout, and there was all sorts of craziness. And the thing I liked about that is it was a very panoramic story, but it wasn't that long, and it was told in sort of a manageable way. And that's what I wanted to do, is I wanted to switch around through different states and different characters. And so I looked at his book just in terms of a way to focus the story, and how do you bring in a bunch of different characters in sort of a loose narrative and tie it all together. And I thought, you know, Mahler did that really well.
You know, one thing that I find very interesting is that you were quickly able to find some templates for yourself. When you knew you wanted to write this book, you didn't have any experience writing books. So had you given yourself a program of reading political books before the idea of writing this book came up?
Yeah, I mean, I had always sort of read quite a bit, and I'd always read a lot of books, and I'd always tried to read political books because that's what I covered for The Nation. And so I entered this process, you know, fairly literate. And these were books that I'd already read, but I referred back to them once I sort of figured out what my subject matter was going to be.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Writers' Voices. I'm your host, Monica Hadley. My guest host today is Cheryl Fusco Johnson, and our guest is Ari Berman, author of Herding Donkeys, The Fight to Rebuild the Democratic Party and Reshape American Politics.
So I'm sure that many of the aspiring writers who are listening want to hear more about how you were able to discipline yourself enough to tackle this task, because we already have heard you say, you know, you didn't know if you had only written these articles that were, what, 5,000 words long, and here you have.
Yeah.
So how did you break it up into chunks, and how did you keep track of these 200 people that you interviewed? I mean, this is a pretty daunting.
Well, it wasn't easy, and there wasn't a tried and true method. I mean, the first thing, even writing a book proposal, I'd never done before, so I asked a few different friends of mine, and I asked my agent to send me some book proposals, and then I got a sense of, okay, this is what a book proposal looks like. And luckily for me, I had already written, you know, two big Nation stories on the topic, and so that made it a lot easier to write, because I essentially used those as a template and then kind of wove in some new writing and new ideas and sort of a roadmap of where I wanted to go. But I wasn't starting from scratch. In terms of the book, though, I mean, once I sold it, it was really, you know, I drafted a list of everyone I wanted to interview, which I kept adding to, and then I said, okay, I'll start with these people, and then I knew kind of who to start with, but then I had to build it out from there, and I did a lot of reporting, you know, in a period of time, and I kind of went nuts reporting, and then I'm like, oh my God, I have way too much information. I need to start writing. And so after I had interviewed, I don't know, like 50 people or something, I decided I was going to start writing the first chapter. And then because I felt like, well, once I started writing, I would figure out what I actually needed. Because sometimes I wasn't particularly sure what I needed from an interview, and it was getting sort of aimless, and I realized I needed to really focus. And at the same time, I knew, through a process of elimination, I knew I wanted to pick three different states that would really the story around. I knew that I wanted it to take place from a time period of roughly 2003 to the present, and I knew that not every state would begin in 2003, but I knew that every state would at least begin in 2008, and if not in 2006, because that's really when Democrats took back the congressional majority. So I said, okay, well, what are the three, you know, most interesting states that went from red to blue? And that's how I decided what they were going to be, and then I eventually picked Indiana, North Carolina, and Colorado for different reasons. I picked Indiana because it was such a surprising story. It hadn't gone for Democrats since 1964, and it kind of epitomized, you know, the Republican heartland to me. I picked North Carolina again, which hadn't gone for a Democrat, I think, since 1976. And the interesting thing about North Carolina was that it really represented sort of the changing nature of the South, the New South. And a lot of the stereotypes about the South didn't really hold there. And then the third place I picked was Colorado, just because I wanted a Western state. And there was such an incredible amount of activism there. Democrats didn't hold any major seats in Colorado the day before the 2004 election, and after the 2008 election, they held every single one. And so I was interested, you know, how did that happen, and just the whole Western conversation, which I think is going to loom larger and larger in terms of the American story. And so I picked those states, and then I sort of drilled down on, you know, who do I want to focus in on these states, and it kept sort of being a process of elimination. And then after a few months of doing this, maybe 5 or 6 months, I kind of got in a rhythm, and I had enough material, and then I basically wrote a chapter a month by the end. But and I knew that I needed to do that, and that was a really, they were long chapters, so it was a very accelerated timetable. But I worked pretty quickly, so I was comfortable with it. It's just that I knew that I needed to be very disciplined, and I essentially had no life for a year. I mean, I didn't really see people. I hunkered down. I worked every single day. And I mean, some people, I know some of the writers say, well, they give themselves quotas or goals. They say, I need to write 500 words a day. And I didn't do that. I worked in bursts, but what I did is I said, I need to do something every day. I either need to do an interview or make a list of who to interview or write something or do some reading or do some reporting. And I made sure I did that pretty much every day. Otherwise, I knew I just wasn't going to get it done.
Were you able to take a leave from your day job while you were doing
this? Yeah, and that was the other lucky thing is, I mean, I took a leave. I mean, it was unpaid, but I took a leave from my job from March through really the new year. So from like March 2009 until, I forget when it restarted, but basically 9 month leave from my job, which was really helpful because there's just no way I could have done it. I mean, it was a full-time job and more writing the book.
Now, I'm curious, just from kind of a legal standpoint, you mentioned that you had written these articles for The Nation that were part that you were able to use in this, and you had done some of the, maybe some of the interviews and some of the connections. Now, when you were writing, because you were on staff with them, do you still, do you have full, complete access to everything that you did while you were writing?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I never really thought about that. I mean, my feeling was, you know, I wrote those articles, and now I'm writing the book, so if I'm going to appropriate them as needed, and I'll just list them in the notes. If so, and I mean, the other thing is that the Nation got the first excerpt of it. So in a way, even though I did it for another publishing house, I mean, it was still complimentary to my job at the Nation. And I think that, luckily, I think my editors viewed it that way.
Now, the book starts out focusing on the Howard Dean campaign from 2003. And reading it, it sounds like you were there. Were you there for parts of this?
I was there for some of it. It's interesting. I mean, I was not there for a lot of these decisions that were made. But I mean, I interviewed the people to the point where I feel like I was there, and that obviously happens a lot in books. I watched a lot of video online. And I read, and luckily the interesting other thing is that I was given a ton of transcripts because a friend of mine did a documentary about the Dean campaign. She gave me all her transcripts. So in a sense, I was there because I had real-time transcripts, which was really cool. That was sort of the one aspect of archival history I was able to do.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I was in Iowa. I was actually in Iowa right before the Iowa caucus in 2004. And so I wasn't in the room when Dean gave the infamous scream speech, but I mean, I was there in terms of, I knew what it was like, I knew what the weather was like, I knew what the political climate was like, and so that helped. Same with the Obama stuff. I mean, I was at some of it, I wasn't at some of it. I was able to rely, luckily, I mean, the Obama campaign, especially, some of the Dean campaign, but especially the Obama campaign, has a very extensive video record of a lot of different campaign events and stories, and so I was really able to piece things together a lot easier than I would have normally just by relying on a lot of that primary material.
Explain also to listeners about when you were still in journalism school and you took David Axelrod's class. I think that was kind of interesting. It sort of seems almost where this book originated.
In some ways, my interest in this topic goes back to 2003, And that's, I guess, we could say sort of indirectly where the seeds of the book come from, because when I was a senior at Northwestern, I took a class with David Axelrod, who later became Barack Obama's chief strategist and media consultant. And it was a political communications class, and Axelrod was better known then as an advisor for John Edwards' presidential campaign. So he was kind of in and out of the class, but I remember as part of the class we had to volunteer for a candidate. Basically, strictly as an immersion assignment and then write about it so that we would have a first-person perspective on it. And so at this point in time, Barack Obama was really unknown, but out of the 25 kids in my class, I'd say at least 15 of them volunteered for Obama, and I said, you know, who is this Obama guy? Why is everyone volunteering for him? And I thought of myself as relatively politically knowledgeable then, and I had no idea who he was, so obviously the broader public had no idea who he was, but and then Obama later, you know, came out of nowhere to win that primary, and so that primary for the Senate in 2004, so I really kind of early on had a very, very early window into Barack Obama and this grassroots enthusiasm for him because, like I said, you know, all these young people in my class who I think were fascinated by him very, very early on way before he'd become a media phenomenon. There was some sort of bond there. And then the second thing that happened is, you know, as I said, that we had to volunteer for that class, and I volunteered for the Dean campaign, which I didn't talk about in the book because I thought it would, you know, it would sort of jeopardize the objectivity that I was going for. But nonetheless, I volunteered for the Dean campaign because I thought the Dean campaign was really fascinating, and I liked the fact that Dean was against the war, but I also just thought, you know, his campaign was incredibly innovative, and I wanted to sort of see firsthand the innovation of it. I mean, instead what I saw was the dysfunction of it because I was there at the very moment it was all falling apart in Iowa. But I still think I benefited from having that perspective because, like I said, you know, Dean sends these 3,000 kids into Iowa. They're known as the perfect storm, wearing these, you know, orange hats. And I saw all that firsthand. And so I thought that sort of enriched my experience of the campaign. And then after, you know, if you remember, there's this infamous scream moment where Dean lists all these states and everyone in the media really blew it up, and I really thought they blew it out of proportion. And ever since then, I really thought that, you know, Dean had gotten a raw deal, and I felt like a lot of the innovation in his campaign was missed by people. And I thought that, you know, when he became chair of the party, I thought people didn't really understand what he was trying to do. And I thought, you know, even with the Obama campaign, that no one really seemed to be giving him credit for the fact that the Obama people were really building on what he had started. And I really felt like Dean was being written out of history. And so to me, you know, it wasn't an endorsement of Dean, it was just the fact that, you know, this happened. He was a fascinating character, and I felt like, you know, telling his story would be really interesting, and I thought it would also just be really valuable as a historical basis. You know, people can pick up the book and say, you know, listen, this was the first campaign of the 21st century. Here's what it was like.
Did you interview Howard Dean for your book?
Yeah, a lot, yeah. I approached him after the election, and I basically said, you know, here's the story I want to write, and I'm not going to do it unless you agree to talk to me for it. And he basically said, sure, you know, we'll talk, and then you can do whatever you want with the material. And so I ended up interviewing Dean maybe like 7 or 8 times, which was really interesting. And I think, you know, like I said, I mean, no one had really done that before. I was given, you know, at least access to him that no one else had really had. And so even though, you know, he's not a huge player, well, he's still a major player in the Democratic Party, but I mean, he's obviously, you know, he's not president, he's not chair of the party, he's a little bit removed from the political discourse today, but I mean, I still think, you know, he is a major figure in American politics in the last, you know, 5 or 6 years. And so just to be able to talk to him in extensive interviews about that was, for me, one of the highlights of doing the book.
And have you gotten any feedback from him about the book since it came out?
Yeah, I mean, we actually did a launch event in New York City together, and I interviewed him.
Cool.
And I think, you know, he really likes it. I mean, like I said, you know, he didn't really ask to change. He didn't influence the editorial shaping of it. But I think, you know, not only was it interesting to him, I think he actually learned a lot through it because I think, you know, even some of the stuff about his campaign, but certainly the whole Obama section, because the first half of the book is really about Dean and his activists, and the second part of the book is really about Obama and his activists. And I think, you know, I don't think he really even knew about a lot of the Obama section. And so I think, you know, that was interesting to him too. And I think, you know, he thinks he's gotten a sort of a raw deal by the press. And so I think, you know, he likes this because, you know, not only does it tell what he views as an accurate representation of the story, but, you know, Dean is relatively pugnacious, and the story stirs some things up. So I think he liked that too.
So, but that does bring us, the idea of the launch party brings us to post-publication. Like, what has that been like for you, having to now publicize your book?
I mean, it's very, very different than the writing of it. I mean, the writing is very solitary, and to an extent, you have control over it, right? I mean, that is one thing that's nice about it. I mean, it's your sentences, and you can change them. It also can drive you crazy, but it is one nice thing about it. I mean, the publicity is just a whole different level. I mean, you know, you really don't have a lot of control over what you're booked on and when you're booked, and you can't really, you kind of go crazy thinking about it, and, you know, you don't know how people are going to respond to it. You don't know if you're going to get reviewed. You don't know what the reviews are going to say. And so it's really a whole new frontier. And so for me, it's just about, you know, thus far just trying to enjoy the process and not get too caught up in, you know, how it's selling or what people are saying or all those stuff. I mean, of course, you check all that information, but at the same time, it's just you have to realize, you know, you're really lucky to have done a book. I'm really lucky to have done a book, and I'm really lucky that people are reading it and talking about it. And, you know, whatever happens from there is just sort of icing on the cake. And being able to travel around the country and talk about it is pretty cool. I mean, I can tell you, I've just done week one, and it's pretty exhausting. But already, you know, I've been at this launch event with Howard Dean, and I did an event the next night with Arianna Huffington of the Huffington Post in New York, and then I was in Atlanta at the Jimmy Carter Presidential Library, and then I was at Little Rock at the Clinton School of Public Service, and then I'll be going down to D.C. This week. I'm doing another event with Dean at Politics and Prose, and then I'm doing another event with Chris Hayes of The Nation that's co-sponsored by some think tanks down there, and then I'm going to Texas for the Austin Book Festival, and then it's just kind of off to the races after that. I have a bunch of cities, including Iowa City, in a short period of time. And so,
yeah, when is Iowa City?
It's October 21st at Prairie Lights.
Prairie Lights, and that's at 7 something?
7 p.m.
7 p.m.
So hopefully I'll still be alive in a month.
Fortunately, you're very young, so that's good. But you must be quite gratified by your reviews. You did get a starred review at Kirkus, for example.
Yeah, no, I mean, that was really cool, and, you know, we got a really nice review in the Wall Street Journal by a conservative writer, nonetheless, so I think that was nice. I mean, because it is the Journal and because they lean more conservative, it was nice to sort of see the other side of the aisle recognize it as a book and give really a glowing review. And so, you know, those sort of things are things that, you know, just wouldn't ordinarily happen to me, and that's one of the benefits of having a book.
Have you had any situations where, like in interviews, where it's been confrontational at all? Because
well, I haven't really done. I've had pretty friendly interviews thus far. I mean, even when I was on MSNBC on Morning Joe, the host seemed pretty enthusiastic about the book. So, but I am starting to do more conservative radio with people who are, you know, pretty anti-Obama, and we'll see what happens with that. I mean, the book is critical of the Democrats. I mean, it's about Democrats, but it's also critical of them, and the book is analytical. I mean, it makes an argument, but at the same time, you know, it's not a polemic. So I want to try to talk about it in a very rational, balanced way. And so in that sense, you know, I'm not getting on TV or getting on radio and yelling about it. It's just not that kind of book. And I didn't write it for that reason. And so I'm not sure, you know, how many confrontational interviews I'll do, but there's no doubt that, you know, some people, for whatever reason, are bound to dislike it, but I haven't experienced that yet.
You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Ari Berman, author of Herding Donkeys, The Fight to Rebuild the Democratic Party and Reshape American Politics.
Ari, I did want to get back to fiction techniques. You've told us a little bit about the template books that you used, and those were all political nonfiction books. And I'm wondering, I know that you have read widely, and when you were in high school, you took a short story class with me where we read a different short story every day for the whole, you know, semester. And I'm wondering how you feel, like, did fiction, reading fiction, influence the way you wrote this book?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I think reading literary nonfiction really influenced it, and I think obviously, you know, literary nonfiction is it's called that because it's very influenced by fiction, and I generally speaking in my life try to read more fiction than nonfiction because, like I said, I think books are partly a refuge, and I try to read stuff that gets me out of the political mind state that I'm in throughout the day and in my day job. So, you know, trying to, you know, use some of those techniques that really make interesting fiction, and when applicable, putting them into nonfiction. And so I do think that I was sort of influenced by that. I have to say, I don't know how anyone writes fiction. I mean, it's just, I only know how to work with the material I have, and that material is really generated through my reporting. And so I thought of myself, first and foremost as a reporter, and then secondarily as a writer, because my writing was based on my reporting. And I know, you know, some people that do fiction do a lot of reporting on their subject matter, and then they write from there. But I'm not sure I could ever do that.
So, Ari, at what point were you sure that you wanted to write a book?
I mean, I really didn't think I was sure until after the election. I mean, when the idea was first proposed to me, and then I thought about it, and I realized that A, you know, it was an idea that I was passionate about, and B, that I knew enough about the material to confidently do it, and to know that whatever I did could stand up as a book, and then, you know, I would feel comfortable about defending the material. And so that was really when I thought about doing it. I mean, it wasn't like I had some long-held ambition to write a book. I mean, actually, you know, quite the contrary, as I said earlier, I mean, people were trying to get me to write books, and I kept saying no, partly because I knew how difficult it was going to be. And I was sort of a perfectionist about it once I got going, even though I had a limited amount of time, which made me be less of a perfectionist, because, you know, I couldn't obsess over every page if I had to hand a manuscript in under a year. And so I knew this was not going to be a book that I could take 5 years on. And actually, for me, the accelerated time frame was good, because I think I would have kind of gone crazy if it lasted longer than a year or two. Again, another thing I don't understand is how people are able to spend 5 or 10 years on a book without just, you know, going crazy.
Was the timing, did that come from the publisher?
Yeah, they wanted it to come out before the midterm elections. Okay. Because the timing of it is such that if it doesn't come out before the midterms, then you really have to wait till the spring of 2011, because books don't really come out during the holiday season, and they don't really come out right afterwards either. And so then it would be a whole different story, and it would have to be a lot more of a look to 2012, and, you know, the history of it would get more dated, and the sort of up-to-date fights would be more out of date. And so, really, I mean, the good thing is that, you know, my book really ends with that after the healthcare debate, but this sort of dynamic of the book where, you know, Democrats are sort of spinning out of control and the Republicans are ascendant, I think is still this sort of general narrative. And so in some sense, you know, the history of the book hasn't gone out of fashion, I don't think, you know, because it's the history, I don't think it will, but at the same time, you know, the more current parts have thus far stood up, which I'm glad about.
I'm interested in what you have on your bedside table, like after you have done all this political reporting. what kind of junk reading do you do? Is it really junk, or is it?
Yeah, like I've been reading all the Stieg Larsson books. Like, I'm not joking. I mean, it was just. I can't even remember what I mean. I know I did read some sort of higher brow books, I'm sure.
At some point.
I read Clockers by Richard Price. I think he's a really great writer, actually. And I've read almost all of his books, and I think he's really sort of underrated, very good crime writer. And so I read that recently, and I can't remember what I read, but yeah, I mean, I got really into it was the summer and whatever, and I just needed a distraction, so I started reading the Dragon Tattoo books, which I have to say are actually pretty good.
They are very good.
Yeah,
very good.
I mean, for mass fiction, they're a lot better than James Patterson, for example, or even Michael Crichton or someone like that. I mean, and they're pretty subversive. I mean, they're very left-wing. I mean, they're about, you know, I mean, the original title of the first book was going to be called, I think, you know, Men Who Hate Women, which is very provocative. And so I think that's kind of interesting, is like how this book, which is, you know, written by a very left-wing Swedish guy, became such a bestseller in America, which is, you know, you know, a relatively subdued, straight-laced, even in some ways conservative country. And I think a lot of people are reading it without really noticing the politics of it, which I think is sort of the genius of the book.
Well, do you identify with the character who's the investigative journalist?
A little bit. I mean, like I said, it's sort of absurd. I mean, it's not particularly believable. But I mean, any book that puts a journalist at the center, I think journalists are going to relate to. There's a book I really want to read that I haven't read yet, called The Imperfectionists, which is all about newspaper reporters at Rome and this sort of falling apart newspaper. And I just haven't gotten around to it, but I heard it's very good.
It's always fun to have a book to look forward to that you're excited about. Looking back at your career, say when you're 80, do you think you might dip into writing fiction?
I don't think I'm ever going to write fiction, just because I don't think my brain really works that way. I don't think I'm imaginative enough to do it. And I think a lot of nonfiction writers, when they write fiction, tend to write sort of bad fiction. I mean, I think writing fiction is even harder than writing nonfiction. I think there's a limited amount of people that do it well. And the other thing is that the economics of writing fiction are very difficult. I mean, you have to really have finished an entire novel, unless you're very high profile, before you can sell it.
It's
Whereas
true.
I was able to sell a book proposal that was, you know, 60 pages. So
yeah, even though you had never written a book
it's easier
before.
To write, it's easier to sell nonfiction
yeah.
books.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that process. You mentioned that you had an agent prior to this. What did you have an agent for if you hadn't written a book or weren't writing a book? What were they doing?
Well, I mean, when he approached me, when my agent approached me to do the Daily Outrage book, I decided to say no to the book, but I said yes to the agent because I felt like, you know, eventually I'd write a book. And if there was a good agent that was after me, it just made sense to have one. And then it also sort of gave me a cachet in terms of just to say I had an agent, and, you know, if a book idea ever manifested, I knew that, you know, he would do a good job selling it. And so after that, we just would sort of every once in a while bounce ideas off each other. And then we started thinking sort of more concretely about different ideas that we had. And then that eventually, when I approached him with this book idea, you know, he was into it. And he helped me. And then that was just a great benefit because I wasn't starting from scratch and saying, okay, you know, writers approach me and they don't have an agent, and it's very difficult to sort of find an agent. I mean, usually agents approach you, and so I started off in a relatively good position.
Yeah, because for a lot of writers, finding an agent is like finding the Holy Grail, and for you to just have one in your back pocket in case you decided to write a book, that's pretty cool.
Is your agent now suggesting your next book?
No, we're not really, luckily we're not really there yet.
Okay, so you had the book idea, you talked to your agent, he gave you some instruction on how to write a book proposal.
Yeah.
And you did that, and then did it get shopped around? How difficult was it to find the publisher?
That was frantic. Oh my God, it was like the most stressful week of my life. Because I told my agent that first thing, I had to do the book proposal very quickly. I mean, essentially, I had finished it right after Obama's inauguration, and I started it not that long after the election. So I did the book proposal in like a month or two. So that was a pretty accelerated process, too, honestly. And I had to kind of, you know, work really hard to get that done. And then, yeah, I mean, the way it worked is that we had a proposal and we agreed on it, and some people read it and offered comments, but, you know, very quickly. And so we had a proposal we felt good about, and then but there was two things that were working against us. I mean, one was the publishing industry was really collapsing at that point. If you don't remember this, but there was massive layoffs in sort of January, February of 2009. And so I was like, uh-oh, like, is there going to be a publishing industry in general? And then the other thing was that a lot of books about Obama had already been sold, about the campaign or about different aspects. So I already knew that I was selling it at a bad time, and B, a bunch of people had already gotten in the door before me. But I felt confident that we had, you know, a unique enough story. It's just we had to find a house that was okay with it, and you know, and there was a few different people that were interested in it, from the beginning, so that was good. But at the same time, you know, I told my agent I wanted to see all the rejection letters to see what people were saying about it. And it just so happened that, you know, we got about 14 rejection letters before we eventually found the house, before the house for our Strauss and Giroux that we ended up going with contacted us. So it was a fairly stressful 2 or 3 days before that meeting.
And what did you learn from the rejection letters?
Well, the rejection letters were actually weirdly hopeful because you could tell, A, people had read it because they were offering very detailed notes, and B, that they liked the material, but for whatever reason, it just didn't work. Do you know what I mean? And so I found those to be, you know, plausible explanations. It wasn't like they were just brushing us off. It was like they were grappling with it, and, you know, like I said, I mean, different houses are different specific. It's a big deal, you know, to buy a book. And so it just wasn't working out, and it just, you know, we just had to find the right house to do it, and, you know, we ended up finding a, you know, a very well-respected house that, you know, publishes a lot of fiction and literary nonfiction, too, FSG, and then I had the pressure of, okay, no, now I can't disappoint. I can't blacken the FSG name, you know.
Tell the listeners a little about that meeting. We have to finish pretty soon, but that meeting that you had with Farrar, Straus, and Giroux.
Yeah, well, it was kind of a terrifying meeting going in because I really didn't know what to expect, and I was meeting with the editor-in-chief and the publisher, so I was meeting with the two most high-level people there, and so, and I had never been in one of these meetings before, and I didn't really know much about the literary world, so I was quite nervous, and they started asking me some questions about what is Howard Dean doing now, and I sort of started rambling, and I felt very young and sort of insecure while I was talking, and then about 10 minutes in, you know, they said, okay, well, we want to do the book with you, so let's just figure out how to make it happen. And then I just felt totally relieved, like, okay, well, now I don't have to worry about it anymore. I've clearly made a good impression. And then basically, you know, the story that that I had envisioned was the story that they went with. Now, they made some good suggestions. They wanted me to tighten the narrative, not make it too much about the long arc of the Democratic Party, really start with Dean and then make it from Dean to Obama. And the interesting thing is, you know, a lot of the book was about the 50-state strategy that Howard Dean did, which was to boost local Democratic parties across the country, and that was really the sort of thematic approach for the book, which is also what Obama did with the 50-state, I used to call, you know, the 50-state strategy became the 50-state campaign, and so my editor said something that was very interesting to me. He said, you know, write a biography of the strategy. Mm-hmm. And that really, I really said, okay, well, that makes sense. I can, you know, now I have a more concrete way of looking at it.
Yeah,
and
you know,
the whole book wasn't about that, just that one strategy, but I mean, that was a key part of the book. And so I really tried to tell the anatomy of it, and that was, you know, based on their suggestions. So it was just little things that they told me that that really helped along the way.
I think that having that kernel of, you know, write a biography of the strategy was so helpful because it does narrow down, keep you focused on what it is that you're trying to write.
Yeah, and I think writers always try to do too much. It was like I was trying to tell this whole history of the Democratic Party from Roosevelt and up through Clinton, and they were like, you know what, just ditch all that. You can refer back to it, you know, on a page here or a page there, but, you know, we didn't pay you to write a history of the Democratic Party. I mean, the history that you should tell should be as contemporary as possible, and one that people don't really know. And so that's what I really tried to do is, you know, tell the story that I felt like wasn't being told, and that's really what animated me all throughout the process.
Ari, I've got to ask you about the title, Herding Donkeys. Where'd that come from?
That was, weirdly enough, the title of the proposal, and I never thought it would survive, and it just did. And I think I coined it, but it's hard to even really remember right now because we had these long brainstorming sessions, and I had a few different other titles I was thinking about, but you know, I think Herding Donkeys was good because, A, it was appropriate, and, B, it lightened the subject matter up a little bit. So you could tell someone what the book is about, and they would laugh a little bit, and that would disarm them a little bit. And then you'd have the long, clunky subtitle that explained what the book is about. and so that was really the formula we followed, and I think, you know, generally speaking, people seem to really like the title, and I thought that, you know, FSG would figure out how to put a more sort of literary-sounding title on it, but I guess they never did.
No, I think this is the right way to go.
It's memorable. People will remember.
Yeah.
Do you have any last advice for aspiring writers?
I don't know. I don't really think I'm really at the point in where I can really give advice. but I think it's just, you know, I think you just have to find a subject matter that you're really passionate about and that you feel like you're uniquely qualified to write about. I mean, I think, you know, for me, it was a lot of people were writing about American politics and a lot of people were writing about Obama and the Democratic Party, but they weren't writing about the angle I was writing about. And as long as I felt confident that other people weren't writing about it, I felt like I could do a good job. And I think that's probably applicable in a lot of different instances for a lot of different people. And so to me, that's the thing, is like, carve out your niche and then, you know, write about what you know, and then usually if you can do those two things, then you have a good shot of you know, both selling the book and then doing a successful one also.
Ari, what's the most important message you would want a reader to come away from this book with?
Well, I just think that the message was really, you know, the sort of power of grassroots politics and the power of organizing and activism, and that, you know, that's really what has historically changed the country, and I think that's what historically changed the Democratic Party, and I think even if you look at the Tea Parties, I mean, that's really what's motivating the Republican right now, too. And then I think just that the other thing is just this idea that the country is just a lot more fluid than we think it is, you know, that places change and they adapt, and that, you know, it's not just a bunch of, like Obama said, it's not just like a bunch of red states and a bunch of blue states, that, you know, it's a significantly more complicated, more interesting country than the stereotypes say. And so that to me, those were the two sort of animating features that made me want to write the book.
Well, thank you so much for joining us on Writers' Voices.
Thanks for having me. That was fun.
It was great to chat with you again.
I'm losing my voice, so I should go water.
Well, that's a long time to talk. And so for listeners, if you're listening on Friday, stay tuned for Planet Erstwhile with James Moore. And if you're listening on Monday morning, stay tuned for some great music. And you can always check out our archives at KRUUFM.com and at writersvoices.com. See you next week on Writers' Voices.